Welcome back to the Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. I'm Brittany Sheets here with Angela Bachman on this fine Friday.
Happy Friday, Brittany. It's happy, nice to be on the air.
Happy Friday. We're going to have some fun here today. Now, gearing up for an exciting show. We've got, Aaron's coming in. We've got some exciting stuff on the docket. And to kick things off, we're going to talk a little bit about education. We have Maggie Severins, the education reporter with Politico, joining us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about an article here. It's The Hill's Fight on No Child Left Behind Looms. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, one thing that has been going on in Washington the last few weeks that people have had a really close eye on in the education community, but it hasn't quite been gearing up, you know, garnering the big headlines yet, is that lawmakers are starting in on a pretty serious attempt to rewrite No Child Left Behind, which is the 2002 education law that does most of the governing for K-12 schools at the federal level. So it's, you know, right now the Senate is just starting to move ahead, but there's a bill out, a draft bill from the Senate Health Committee's new chairman, Lamar Alexander, that would make some pretty drastic changes to the education system. So I think people are just watching and kind of waiting for the debate to unfold.
What kind of changes are being proposed in this bill?
So Alexander is really focused on giving a lot of education power back to the state. No Child Left Behind, the 2002 law, represents a high watermark when it comes to federal control over education. And the reason that they did that is because there was concern that states and localities weren't holding up their end of the bargain, especially when it comes to educating disadvantaged students. So low-income students, English language learners, students with disabilities, all of these students people feared were not getting enough focus, not getting enough attention in schools. Now, what Alexander thinks is that there should be more decision-making and more autonomy left up to schools, to states, and how they go about delivering that education than there is currently. So he would do a lot of things. I mean, he would trim back the role of the education secretary. He would change the system for how states decide how they're going to educate low-income and disadvantaged students. And then he would make a host of other, you know, there's a lot in this bill. There's charter schools, there's English language learners. There are a lot of things that aren't quite in that national spotlight as much that the bill also addresses and that he would shift around.
That's interesting. What's his opposition saying about this?
Sorry?
What's his opposition have to say about it, about these specific proposals?
Oh, okay. I think that'll be really interesting because Democrats and Republicans alike hear a lot from their constituents about frustrations with the school system, and they hear a lot from constituents about how they want to change this law. So I think everyone's feeling a lot of pressure to get something done right now, at least Democrats and Republicans in Congress are. And Democrats really would like, they want to keep that civil rights focus that I mentioned earlier. They want to keep this federal oversight of how states are educating disadvantaged students. So for them, it's about kind of rejiggering the law while keeping all of these, they call them accountability requirements, keeping all of this accountability on states and on districts for what they're doing in schools. So that's kind of the biggest point of tension. And it kind of leads into all these other discussions about education. You know, it leads into discussions about what you should do about federally mandated tests, which is a really hot issue in a lot of states. It leads to questions about what role the federal government should or shouldn't be playing in state standards, like the Common Core, which is obviously something on people's minds right now. So when they're kind of looking at this tension between federal and state roles, it also kind of bleeds into everything else you see in education right now.
I think one of the things that's most talked about in the general public is all of the testing. What's Alexander's position on that?
So Alexander would like to, he has in his draft bill right now two options for testing. One is to keep the current testing structure, which the federal government right now mandates that students take, it's 17 tests over the course of their K-12 school career. So it, you know, averages out to a little more than one a year. Most of them are between third and eighth grade. Alexander also has this second option that would basically let the states and districts decide what they want to do about testing, so long as the results can be kind of compared from district to district at the state level. So basically what he's proposing is maybe we could keep the testing stuff the same, or maybe we just hand this decision making mostly back to states, and that would open up tons of different plans for testing, including, you know, scaling back so students maybe only take 3 or 4 tests over their time in school. So this is something that is, you know, I think Alexander is open to it. I don't think that he necessarily has made up his mind on testing. Teachers unions, at least the National Education Association, which is the country's largest union, have really been pushing for getting rid of a lot of these tests for years now. You saw this week in the Senate, there was a hearing on the testing issue, and 2 of the 6 witnesses were teachers, and both teachers testified that they think we should get rid of the testing requirements and No Child Left Behind. I think to people who are looking at this kind of from an academic's point of view, or people who are looking at this from a civil rights point of view, the thing that concerns them about testing, and I think you'll see a lot of Democrats come down on this side and many Republicans, is that if you take away these tests, it becomes very hard to measure how much a student is growing and how much a student is learning from year to year. So the tests aren't really a perfect way to assess that, but people think that you need to test students to see how things are going in schools.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Do you think there's there might be an option on the table of making better tests rather than just eliminating them completely?
I think that's where people are hoping this debate is going. I think it's something that, and, you know, right now when we look at things in No Child Left Behind, we measure how students are performing from year to year, but we don't necessarily measure how students grow. So that's another thing that I think that lawmakers were hearing a lot of interest in, or starting to hear a lot of interest in, is what if we started measuring, like, you know, how much a teacher changes, what a student knows from the beginning of the year to the end of the year, as opposed to, is that student on grade level in reading? Because a teacher who can bring a student from, like, a 3rd grade to a 5th grade level in reading is actually doing a great job, and that student is doing a great job of learning. So that's kind of, you know, or improving tests is another thing we hear about. I think there are a lot of different ways that people would like to maybe reform the system. I think the question is there too much pressure on the states to just scale back the number of tests? That'll be a big question, I think, moving forward.
Yeah, I agree. I know testing is definitely a very hot ticket button here. I know a lot of people are worried about the fact that people say that it's you anymore, you teach to the test, just because it's like, you know, you have to pass it. And a lot of times that depends on your funding you kind of get. And there's a lot of other aspects that goes into it for the school districts. But I definitely think maybe more of a performance based with that testing would be really great, to see how much that student grows in their academics, not what's their level compared to what the nationwide level is for, like, that age group in that grade or something to that effect.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And I think that another thing that people are starting to zero in on as part of this whole testing problem is that a lot of tests given in schools right now are also mandated by states and mandated by districts, not actually by the federal government. So you've seen a couple of bills come out in Congress from legislators who just say, hey, we need to collect more information about where all these requirements are from, how we could possibly consolidate some of this, and how do we look at improving the quality of tests that students are given. So you're looking at the problem from that angle, as opposed to should we test or should we not test.
Right. And the other thing that I want to point out is that because a lot of schools have had their funding cut, a lot of extra activities that allow for growth of students as people rather than strictly academically have been kind of scaled back. And I think that that might be something that needs to be addressed too. Have they discussed that at all?
You know, I think that you're seeing a little discussion of that, but they're kind of not there yet. Right now they're looking at the more big picture questions, but it's a really interesting point because it goes back to one of the oldest disagreements about No Child Left Behind, which is that they passed this law in 2002 and then Congress never funded it at the level that it was supposed to be. And, of course, during the recession, lots of schools cut their budgets, or I should say lots of states cut school budgets. So I think that one thing that Democrats really feel strongly about is that, in addition to working on this law, you need to be funding schools more. And you need to be funding schools, you know, probably in a different or in a smarter way than we are doing now. And that's going to be a whole, you know, I think some of that's going to play out during debate over No Child Left Behind, but some of that is an appropriations problem. You know, it's a budget problem. And one thing we're seeing in Washington right now is that there's still a lot of tension over the federal government or over the federal budget. and there's still not a ton of room for the education budget to grow in coming years.
Well, Maggie, this has been some really great information here. I know it's this is definitely a big topic, and we're definitely going to see a lot more about this here. But real quick before we go, how can our reader or how can our listeners read more about what you guys do?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So we have coverage up on Politico.com that's going to be, you know, moving forward in the coming weeks and months. I'm on Twitter at Maggie Severns, S-E-V-E-R-N-S. And then we have a morning tip sheet, too, that goes out every day that's free to sign up for. It's called Morning Education, and you can find that on the Politico website.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Maggie. That was Maggie Severns, education reporter for Politico. I'm Brittany Sheets here with Angela Bachman, and you've been listening to the Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio.
As messed up as it sounds, in the unending struggle for justice, there is such a thing as a positive negative. This occurs when you win a struggle that you never should have had to make. A prime example is presented by the long saga of Isis Brantley. In 1997, the Dallas police force raided her school, which taught the cultural art of African-style hair braiding. It was a highly regarded school. Brantley had been braiding hair for years, even attracting music stars like Erykah Badu. But, state authorities barked, she was guilty of this horrific breach of the law, braiding without a barber's license. So she was arrested and, get this, hauled away in handcuffs. But Brantley wasn't barbering, she was braiding. So her case led to a reform intended to make it easier for hair braiders to be licensed for their art. Victory, right? Not so fast. Texas state officials, who loudly professed that they despise regulatory overreach, proceeded to overreach. Braiding artists, they commanded, must convert their shops into fully equipped barber colleges, requiring 10 or more workstations with hair-washing sinks, even though braiding does not involve washing. In 2013, still refusing to submit to this Big Brother authoritarianism, Brantley sued Governor Rick Small Government Perry's Department of Licensing. And now, 17 long years after the Texas state government's ridiculous anti-hair braiding gendarmes raided Isis Brantley's shop, locked her in handcuffs, and ran roughshod over her rights, she has found a measure of justice. A court has ruled that the state's actions are unconstitutional, not to mention arbitrary and abusive, shameful, and silly. This is Jim Hightower saying, right-wingers claim to hate big government intrusion, but where were they when their own government was intruding on Isis Brantley?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
It's about the work. Work we're proud of. Work that provides the energy that powers America. Work that means our communities are stronger, better, for our families, our neighbors, for everyone. Just like you, members of the United Mine Workers of America are on the job, every day, working hard. It's what we do, and it makes America a better place. The United Mine Workers of America, working families just like yours.
Welcome back to the Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. My name is Angela Bachman, and I'm here with Brittany Sheets today.
Hey, everyone.
It's a lovely day, and we are looking forward to our weekly Tinfoil Hat Awards. This week, we have Sal Calalori from Media Matters joining us to give these awards away. Sal, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the party.
Thank you. I know. It's quite the party. It's Friday, so it's about to get crazy, I know.
Ooh, yeah. So
I think I have three good ones this week. I hope. The first one we have is Fox's Eric Bolling. Eric Bolling, I don't know how much you know about his background. He is, I think, in the financial industry and then made a lot of money and somehow took his wares to Fox News and now is the main host of the TV show The Five, which is five Fox News hosts talking about events of the day. So it's as enthralling as you could probably imagine. But he said that Hall of Fame player Mike Ditka was a wussy because he didn't want his son to play football and that it was leading to the wussification of America, things like that. And the reason why is because Mike Ditka has actually been on the forefront of doing concussion studies and doing studies about, you know, like the post-football playing careers of many of the people who played football and noticed that they were having traumatic brain injuries or irreparable damage to their bodies, and saying that, you know, when he basically said, although Bowling doesn't credit this, that, you know, when he played, it was a different era and it was a different time. And while things were harder and hurt more, it wasn't the same level of brutality that's in the game now. So my first one goes to Eric Bowling for calling Hall of Famer Mike Ditka a wussy.
That's really interesting. And I'm wondering what about the game has changed to make it more brutal now. Was that mentioned?
No, I mean, just in, like, probably, you know, from watching it and reading about it in general, I think, you know, the players have gotten bigger, they've gotten faster, and overall, I mean, you know, they know that, I mean, every professional sport, you know, people are just, it's not your run-of-the-mill people anymore, you know, there's more people playing it, and now going into it professionally, whereas, like, when Ditka played, you know, I don't think you have the same level of people who are playing it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We watch college a lot more. High school football is now on television. So, I mean, I think I even saw, like, one time they were showing a middle school football game on ESPN. I was like, this
wow,
is crazy.
My gosh.
Yeah, I was like, those kids are 13. I was like, how do they even, like, I would be, I don't know. At 13, I was not ready to be on television.
No.
I bet they were really excited, though. I mean, how cool would that be?
It's a cool opportunity. But I think, you know, the main thing that Ditka said, you know, too, is, and a lot of people have said about this, is that, you know, the safety and the precautions and the protections need to be higher. And then it would be something that maybe people would go back to again. But, I mean, Ditka's comments echo something that he said, you know, like Obama has said, and a bunch of other people. So he doesn't stand alone on this. But Bowling is willing to let his son play football. So I guess there's still hope for football out there.
And with that, let's move on to the second runner-up.
The second one. Oh, we have Alan West, who, former congressman from Florida, now is I think contractually with Fox News, and he said that the Obama administration is continuing to provide aid and comfort and material support to the enemy, because he was disappointed in the fact that after a convicted terrorist served his sentence, he was freed and then was allowed to go back to Qatar. So that's what Alan West thinks, that the President of the United States is aiding terrorists.
Last time I checked, after you serve your sentence, you have served your sentence and you're set free.
That's the whole point of having a sentence. It's a, you know, usually a limited amount of time.
Yeah. And Alan West has a pretty checkered past himself. He had some issues in the military where he was accused of firing what he calls warning shots, but people around him have said it's a little bit more suspect than that, above the head of someone that he was interrogating who was a prisoner. And it turns out that the person he was interrogating had no knowledge of anything. It was just like a run-of-the-mill civilian who got caught up by West. So he's had his issues over the course of the time. What I think is great, though, is that he actually lives in Debbie Wasserman Schultz district, and that makes me so happy, because every time he talks about his congressperson, he has to talk about Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who he hates. So I think there's, like, a small revenge in that, you know.
Totally. Sometimes I just think that he should not be near firearms or, you know, human beings, while sometimes I also think he might belong in, like, a padded room for his own safety and the safety of the general public.
Yeah, he just shows her. And even recently, we actually caught him plagiarizing an entire chain email.
Really?
He lifted the whole thing, put it on his website, and didn't credit the chain email. Although I don't know how you cite a chain email if you're going to do that anyway. But
and what an intelligent thing to plagiarize, by the way.
Right. It's like, not only is everything in it wrong, but you didn't even get it yourself.
But
like,
you claimed it for your own.
Yeah. Which is embarrassing. Like, I'll be honest, that's pretty embarrassing. If I'm going to steal something from somebody else, it's not going to be a chain email.
I'm almost impressed at, like, the stupidity of it, though.
I hope that at the end of this chain email, it was one of those, like, if you don't send this to 27 other people, you'll have bad luck for 7 years.
I wish they had left that part in. He magically deleted that part, which means that he read it, his post, before he submitted it. So I feel like it's almost worse because he knew what he was doing.
I was just about to say, I was like, that means he was okay with it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, yeah, I mean, it's beyond me. Alan West is an enigma, but that is Alan West in a nutshell right there.
But he is only the second runner-up, so.
He's only the second runner-up. The first place this week goes to a woman named Emily Miller, and she's pretty well-known on the national scale to a certain extent. She is a reporter in Washington, D.C. She actually works for the Washington, D.C.'s Fox affiliate, WTTG, but she also has been on Fox News Channel, the cable network, a bunch, and she has also, I think, a column in the Washington Times. And she became very prominent when she wrote a book called Emily Gets Her Gun, which is a book about her quest to purchase a firearm in the District of Columbia, which was an arduous process for her. Anyway, so Emily Miller decides to go to a rally in Virginia, which was organized by the Virginia Citizens Defense League, which is an extremist gun rights organization who has suggested that violence against the government is an option if the group didn't achieve its goals. And it's also published racially charged articles about how people might need to defend themselves from a group of 20 young urban thugs who are yelling, "Kill Whitey." That's actually not even the worst part. The worst part is that during her speech, when she was introduced, other than the conflict of interest that she is a reporter reporting on something and speaking at the same event, which adds into it, she said during her speech that she is happy. She was happy to be in Virginia because it is part of America where you recognize the Second Amendment. "I came from D.C. this morning, which is not part of America because they don't recognize the Second Amendment."
D.C. is not part of America.
Yeah, so the Washington, D.C. investigative reporter doesn't believe that she lives in America, I guess, or works in America. I don't know. Anyway, it's sad that the whole preface was actually not even the worst part. Like, the worst part was that she said that Washington, D.C. wasn't in America.
Except for the fact it's, the nation's capital.
It's the nation's capital, and also that's where she works, so presumably, I don't know. I don't know if she needs to show a passport every time she enters the district to go to work in the morning.
I feel like some of these people should be required to carry a passport no matter what, just so we know where they came from.
Right, it's like, I just don't get, even and if she lives in D.C., then does she not consider herself an American? I don't know, it's really confusing, the whole process, but I guess she was happy to be in Virginia that day, speaking to a bunch of extremists who think that they should, use an armed insurrection to get what they need. So that's the winner, yeah, somebody beat Alan West.
I didn't know that was possible, not part of America, oh, that is just too funny, this is hilarious.
Yeah. Working in D.C., not working in America. I think that should be her slogan if she ever needs to put something on the resume, worked in D.C., not America.
Not America. Location. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. That's insane.
She might have foreign policy experience. She can say she worked in multiple countries or something. I don't know. I feel like she can leverage this if she works on it,
Sometimes I wonder, where they get this stuff from. And it's just, the chain email or, there's so many things. Yeah. Basic geography lessons.
She might have gotten that from a chain email as well.
That's really possible. Sure. That could have explained all of this. But you know what? They always say there's that commercial where they're just like, "Oh, yeah, I've met this guy. He's a French model. Oh, really? How'd you find him? Oh, the internet. Everything on the internet is true." This is a perfect example of everything on the internet is not true, guys. Everything is true.
And if it is something, in Alan West's case, if it's something you're going to cite, don't at least take credit for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I feel like that's the more embarrassing. That's like when my dad writes stuff on Facebook and he thinks that he's come up with the original idea. I'm like, "Dad, come on." But Alan West is on TV. My dad is not, right? So I feel like there should be, there needs to be a little bit of a higher bar,
West. I totally agree. And this has been fantastic, Sal. But we've got to run. Thank you so much for joining us, though. It's always been great.
Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, no problem. That was Sal Calalori of Media Matters. I'm Brittany Sheets here with Angela Bachman, and you've been listening to The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In a new federal lawsuit, McDonald's workers say there's a widespread pattern of racial and sexual discrimination at three stores in Virginia. The civil rights suit says more than a dozen workers were fired at once at the three Clarksville and South Boston, Virginia stores. According to the workers filing the suit, top managers told them that it was too dark in the restaurants and that they need to get the ghetto out of the store.
The suit also alleges that one supervisor routinely touched female workers inappropriately and offered better working conditions in return for sexual favors. Katrina Stanfield is one of the fired McDonald's workers suing the corporation.
I worked at McDonald's for about a year and a half, and in that time, I faced abuse constantly. My supervisor, Zena Lambert, would regularly harass me and other non-white workers. Whenever I was with other black workers at the store, she would say things like, "It's so dark in here," or make rude comments about our hair or how we looked. After a staff meeting with Zena Lambert, said loudly, "We need to get the ghetto out of the store," which made me feel very uncomfortable. My other supervisor would regularly harass female workers at the store. He made inappropriate comments about the bodies of women at the store. He would touch workers inappropriately and send workers pictures of himself naked.
This lawsuit uses an NLRB ruling that McDonald's is a joint employer responsible for its franchise operations to make its case. The suit asserts that because McDonald's has control over nearly every aspect of its restaurant's operations, it's responsible for the discrimination and harassment the workers are alleging in the lawsuit. The IAM and the Society of Professional Engineers in Aerospace are pushing for conditions to be put on the $8.7 billion worth of tax credit that Boeing is getting from Washington State. The two unions are working to get bills through the state legislature imposing some conditions. One bill would specify the number of jobs that Boeing or any other aerospace company would have to maintain in the state in order to keep the tax credits. Another bill would require companies that get these tax credits to pay living wage jobs. Boeing got the tax credits in November of 2013. Since then, Washington jobs at Boeing have gone down by about 2,500 jobs. Part of the deal that landed the $8.7 billion in tax credits for Boeing was a contract the Machinist Union was pressured to support that ends Boeing pension contributions after 2016. Boeing could face another challenge to the tax credits as well. The European Union is looking at the possibility of challenging the credits under World Trade Organization rules. This newscast made possible in part through support from the United Steelworkers and from the UMWA, the United Mine Workers of America. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.